Welcome everyone to our opening class in a new series. This year we're going to be examining a number of different topics in Jewish and really general philosophy. And we are going to be exploring a whole range of topics, just all over the map, really. A diverse set of issues we'll be looking at. The first topic we're going to be exploring is what we're calling the place of man in the universe, or if some have recommended, the place of the human in the universe. And what I'd like to do is to spend today opening up this issue a little bit, really framing the key questions. And once we've really opened up or framed those questions, hopefully in subsequent classes, we'll be able to explore some of the solutions. But we really cannot explore the solutions until we know what sort of the basic problems are. In a word, if I were to identify the key issue that I'd like to explore in this mini-series as part of this topic of the place of man in the universe, is really the key question as to what extent the human being really is the raison d'etre, is really the ultimate goal of all of creation, and to what extent are we really just another part of that larger process of Briyat Olam, but really we are somewhere in between an afterthought, or if not an afterthought, at least just another part of creation. Other ways of asking this question, related, although somewhat slightly different questions, would run along the lines of, to what extent were the animals or the plants and other parts of creation, to what extent do they have their own intrinsic or independent goals in their own right? Are they created for their own sake? Or really are some of the other parts of creation created in order to service humanity? That would be another closely related question that we'd have to explore. And I think that if we were to be a bit simplistic, but sort of take an impressionistic approach to this topic, I think it's fair to generalize and say that for the most part, for much of the history of humanity and Jewish history in particular, it was generally assumed that the human being was very much at the center of creation, first and foremost philosophically, but as we'll see, closely connected at least at certain points in the study of Jewish philosophy, physically, the centerpieces of earth and creation as well. And this is something that we see not only in Jewish sources, but in general sources as well. If you take a look, I gave you as just an example, Stephen Hawking in his classic Overview of Modern Cosmology, A Brief History of Time, tells a great story. He writes, source number one on the source sheet, a well-known scientist, some say it was Bertrand Russell, once gave a public lecture on astronomy. He described how the Earth orbits around the Sun, and how the Sun, in turn, orbits around the center of a vast collection of stars called our galaxy. At the end of the lecture, a little old lady at the back of the room got up and said, "What you have told us is rubbish. The world is really a flat plate supported on the back of a giant tortoise." The scientist gave a superior smile before replying, "What is the tortoise standing on?" "You're very clever, young man, very clever," said the old lady. "But it's tortoises all the way down." So this is one version of the universe, in which we've got tortoise on top of tortoise on top of tortoise, and Earth as a sort of the top of all, lying at the top of all those tortoises, and the human being at the center of that Earth, runs all the way down. This is the sense as to how the physical world was constructed, and then by extension, again, the place of the human being in that universe. things have changed, as we'll come back to. But this notion with regard to the human being in particular is something that is common to both many sources in both Western and Jewish philosophy. I'll just give a few classic examples, but really just they're really just that. They're just examples of which we could have chosen many, many others. Take a look at the classic Greek tragedy Antigone, authored by Sophocles. So there we read that wonders are many, none is more wonderful than man. The power that crosses the White Sea, driven by the stormy south wind, making a path under surges that threaten to engulf him in Earth, the eldest of the gods. Earth, the eldest of the gods. The immortal, the unwary doth he wear, turning the soil with the offspring of horses as the plows go to and fro from year to year, and the light-hearted race of birds and the tribes of savage beasts. And the seabird of the deep he snares in the meshes of his woven toils. He leads captive man excellent in wit and speech and windsoft thought, and all the moods that mold the state hath he taught himself. So here we find the human being in ways that are actually very much reminiscent of what we read at the beginning of Sefer Bereishit. Ureduat ha'aretz v'chiv shuha, humanity rules over the animal kingdom, rules over the birds, rules over the earth, and the earth in turn is described as the eldest of the gods. So the human being essentially dominates earth. Earth in turn is dominant, is immortal over... He is the eldest of the gods over the rest of existence, and this notion of seeing man as the center of Earth as the center of the universe, is really, I think, a typical one. Of course, when we turn to much substantially later in the history of Western thought, we come to the period of the Renaissance. In particular, one thinker that we'll look at, Pico della Mirandola, who wrote what is widely considered to be one of the most foundational texts of the Renaissance. Really, his magnum opus, and some say sort of encapsulates much of the Renaissance philosophy. So Mirandola writes there, "At long last, however, I feel that I have come to some understanding of why man is the most fortunate of living things, and consequently deserving of all admiration. Of all admiration, of what may be the condition in the hierarchy of beings assigned to him, which draws upon him the envy not of the brutes alone, but of the astral beings and of the very intelligences which dwell beyond the confines of the world. And so God said to man, 'We have given you, O Adam, no visage proper to yourself, nor endowment properly your own, in order that whatever place, whatever form, whatever gifts you may with premeditation select, these same you may have and possess through your own judgment and decision. The nature of all other creatures is defined and restricted within laws which we have laid down. You, by contrast, impeded by no such restrictions, may by your own free will, to whose custody we have assigned you, trace for yourself the lineaments of your own nature.'" Can you imagine a modern writer writing in this way? "Man is the most fortunate of living things, and consequently deserving of all admiration. The hierarchy of beings assigned to him, which draws upon him the envy not of the brutes alone, but the astral beings, the intelligences which dwell beyond the confines of the world, they all look toward man with admiration." I mean, this is really foreign, but this is really a classic text of the period of the Renaissance. No surprise. And this notion of seeing man as relatively unsullied, as the centerpiece of existence, as deserving of all admiration, we find in numerous Jewish texts as well. And in particular, the connection that we've already mentioned between the our metaphysical map of the universe and the place of man philosophically in that universe is particularly, especially drawn by Rav Sadia Gaon in his classic, his philosophical classic, Emunot V'Dayot, in the fourth of his 10 chapters of that work. And Sadia writes, the English translation, "When we see that the creatures are many in number, nevertheless, we need not be confused in regard to which of them constitutes the goal of creation. which for him, of course, can be the human being. For there exists a natural criterion by which we, by means of which we can determine which one of all the creatures is the end. When then we make our investigation with this criterion as a guide, we find that the goal is man. We arrive at this conclusion in the following manner. Habit and nature place whatever is most highly prized in the center of things which are themselves not so highly prized. When therefore we see that this situation appertains to many things, and then find the earth in the center of the heaven, with the heavenly spheres surrounding it on all sides, it becomes clear to us that the thing which was the subject of creation must be on the earth. Upon further investigation of all its parts, we note that the earth and water are both inanimate, whereas we find that the beasts are irrational. Hence, only man is left, which gives us the certainty that he must unquestionably have been the intended purpose of creation. The intended purpose of creation. All things, according to Sa'adya, were created for the sake of man. Man physically occupies the center of the universe, and metaphysically, spiritually, axiologically as well. Sa'adya, very far-reaching. The Maharal as well, in his Tiferes Yisrael and Perek Dalid, just as the sun reigns, so is man a king, for everything is subject to him. Man's royalty expresses itself in that he brings perfection to all earthly creatures, for everything was created in order to serve man and minister to him. I repeat, everything was created in order to serve man and minister to him. So we find many sources at many points in history, which indeed really reinforce the notion that human beings are really the centerpiece. Just to give one other example, in this case, not on the basis of a geocentric model of the universe, as we find especially in Sa'adya, but significantly, at a substantially later point in history, we find this in the Nefesh HaChayim. Rav Chaim of Elazhin, writing in his classic philosophical work, the Nefesh HaChayim, in Sha'ar Aleph, Perek Dalid, and perhaps he feels the need to stress this issue because by the time we come to Rav Chaim, we already find in the 18th century, that early 19th century, we find that the notion of the human being as the centerpiece of creation is already under attack, as we'll see, cosmologically and in other ways as well. And Rav Chaim goes out of his way to stress the centrality of the human being and the ultimate or the omni-significance of our specific actions. Rav Chaim claims that when a person performs a mitzvah or a person engages in an avera, that in fact that individual does not just perform an act here on earth, but that is an act that has cosmic ramifications, cosmic significance in upper worlds that we have no immediate access to, but exist in a way that is perhaps more profoundly true and a more profound or more significant reality for certain than our lowly existence on this earth. When we perform a mitzvah, we create worlds of goodness and perhaps worlds of angels who advocate for us as well. When we perform sinful behavior, we create worlds or we destroy worlds in the celestial spheres, and we perhaps create angels who advocate against us. Writes Rav Chaim in Aleph Dalet, and this is the law of man. No man of Israel should say in his heart, who am I? And what is my ability to effect with my insignificant actions any impact on the world? Rather, he should understand, know, and establish in the thoughts of his heart that the details of all his actions, words, and thoughts at all moments are not lost, God forbid. For each one ascends in accordance with its roots to effect its impact in the upper spheres. And in truth, an intelligent and wise individual who truly understands this, his heart will stammer inside him with fear and trembling when he places upon his heart that his evil acts, God forbid, to what extent reach, that they ruin and destroy through even a minor sin, far worse than the destruction wrought by Nebuchadnezzar and Titus. Nebuchadnezzar and Titus, these are dirty words. These are arch enemies, arch criminals in Jewish history. That's the extent of our destructiveness. So Rav Chaim urges us to recognize the omni-significance of our actions, and that we have the ability to transform the celestial upper spheres in ways that are really unimaginable. So we have a long line of thought to summarize in both the general Western canon as well as Jewish philosophical sources as well, that stress in various ways the centrality of the human being to creation, the notion that all of existence is subservient to us, was created with us as its intended end, as its intended purpose, and that the role of the human being is to dominate all other existence on this earth, and that perhaps cosmologically, physically as well, this fits in nicely on the basis of a geocentric model of the universe, which of course is going to be exactly where we're going in just a moment. But this is what we really find, and the truth is that we already find midrashic roots for this idea. If you take a look at Avos de Rabbi Nassan, Perak Lamed Aleph, Rabbi Nechemya Omer, in source number 8 on your source sheets, Minayin she'adam echad shakul k'neged kol ma'aseh bereishis, from whence do we derive that a single individual is the equivalent of all of creation? Shne'emar, classic pasuk, ze sefer toldos adam, this is the book of the generations of a human being, of man. These are the generations of the heavens and earth when they are created. The Torah uses similar language for the creation of, or the generations of man, as to the generations of heavens and earth. In other words, everything else that is in existence, and thereby equating or comparing between the significance of a single human being and the rest of creation. So this is a very much a prominent theme. But it's one that came increasingly under attack. First of all fairness, I think it needs to be said that even within the Jewish tradition, there are, as we'll have to come back to at greater length, there are hints, at least, even prior to modern times, that perhaps this is not quite as simple. Just one example, or just a few examples. First of all, a similar set of midrashim in context of creation push back a little bit and offer examples in which we are reminded of the smallness of the human being. So that, for example, in Bereshit Rabbah Chet, we read that Damar Reish Lakish V'ruach Elokim Rachevet Al Pnei Amayim Zerucho Shel Melech HaMashiach Heyach Ma Da'at Amar V'nachal Avruach Hashem Im Zacha. What does it mean that the Spirit of God will rest upon him if a person, in Pasuk Mishael and Perek Yud Aleph, in context of the messianic vision of the lion and the lamb and so on, Im Zacha Adam, if a person is meritorious, so then Omrim Lo, we say to him, Atakadam to Malachi Asharis, you preceded even the creation of the angel, the Imlav. But if not, Omrim Lo, we remind him, yeah, maybe the Malachim came afterward, but look who came first. Zivuv Kadamcha, Yitush Kadamcha, Shilshulzet Kadamcha, these little creatures, these insignificant insects, they all preceded you. Snails came before you. You're a gornish, you are nothing, human being. And we are put in our place. So Chazal in this Midrash remind us of our smallness. And similarly, the Tosefta in Sanhedrin, Perek Ches, Halacha Dalin, Lama Nivra Ba'achrona, why was the human being created last? Not because we are the end of all creation, but rather, Shem Tezuach Da'ato Alav, that if he becomes overly arrogant, Omer Lo, so then what do we say to him? Alright, Yetush Kadam Chabimasa Bereshis. Don't forget, the mosquito preceded you in the creation of the world. Further, the Rambam in his Mor Nevuchim seems to take adopt a position that clearly is counter to the perspective formulated by Rav Saadia Gaon, who preceded the Rambam by some period of time. Saadia lives from 882 to 942. The Rambam approximately roughly 1035 to 1204. So the Rambam is living some 200 years after Rav Saadia Gaon. And the Rambam pushes back a little bit. And the Rambam actually suggests in his Moram, this is in Chilak Gimel, in section Yud Gimel, section 13, the Rambam suggests that yes, it's true that many other existences or creations were brought into being for the sake of the human being. But let's remember that the human being himself is certainly not the end goal of creation. And the Rambam writes, to my mind, the correct view according to the beliefs of the law of view that corresponds likewise to the speculative views is as follows. In other words, Judaism and the philosophical tradition are aligned. it should not be believed that all the beings exist for the sake of the existence of man. So this is a direct attack on Asadya, a point of disagreement. Not all beings exist for the sake of man. On the contrary, all the other beings too have been intended for their own sakes and not for the sake of something else. So clearly the Rambam pushing back on that point against Rav Saadya. Just as he has willed that the human species should come to exist, he has also willed that the spheres and their stars should come to exist. And he quotes Psukim in Mishle in support of this contention. And then the Rambam says, "Hence, be not misled in your soul to think that the spheres and the angels have been brought into existence for our sake. For it has explained to us what we are worth. Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket." A pasuk in Yeshayahu Parak Mem, pasuk Tetvav. "Consider accordingly your substance and that of the spheres, the stars, and the separate intellects, the sichlim hanivdalim, as the Rambam calls them. Then the truth will become manifest to you, and you will know that man and nothing else is the most perfect and the most noble thing that has been generated from this inferior matter. It's true, he is the most perfect of existence of creation, but that if his being is compared to that of the spheres, and all the more to that of the separate beings, it is very, very contemptible." The Rambam here clearly drawing on Neoplatonist thought, the notion of the separate intellects of the Sechlim HaNivdalim. And essentially, this is a theory which is a sort of a counter, in many ways, to Kabbalistic theory that offers an accounting of the creation of the human beings as a series of divine emanations from the divine. Along those series of emanations, we have angels, different celestial spheres, these angelic beings, however exactly we understand them, as closer to the active intellect, or closer to the divine source of that intellect, namely the divine, namely God, than the human being. The human being may be higher up than some of the other beings on this earth, but they are not created for the sake of man, just as man is not created for the sake of the spheres. Each individual entity or part of creation has its own independent significance and purpose to having been created, and moreover, the human being occupies a lower sphere on the set of levels of the active intellect than to the spheres, the stars, and the separate intellect. So the Rambam really pushes back here on the basis of his understanding of Jewish Neoplatonist philosophy, cosmology really, and metaphysics, and the Rambam on that basis disagrees with Rav Saadya Gaon with regard to the purpose of creation as well as man's place in the universe. So I do not mean to say that all is clear or agreed upon. There are debates with regard to these issues. There are midrashim chalukim. There are midrashim that cut in different directions or emphasize different aspects of humanity. And it's not all as simple as to say that for thousands of years we thought that everything was about the human being, and now we've realized that that was in fact primitive and utterly incorrect. There was a lot of dialogue and back and forth and a range of views, even prior to our having discovered that lo and behold, the universe, or the solar system, to be more precise, is heliocentric rather than geocentric. But I think that the generalization still holds, even as we see that things are a little bit more complex than that. As an aside, anyone who's interested in taking a look at or exploring more fully this debate between the Rambam and Rav Saadya Gaon, take a look at Rabbi Lam, his Faith and Doubt. I believe it's the fourth chapter, and he has an essay comparing and especially contrasting the Rambam and Saadya's views on this critical philosophical question. Now, the larger picture remains, which is that the generalization, I think, holds, and it's true that for thousands of years, this was the overall thrust. Of course, in modern times, this notion, perhaps oversimplified notion, of seeing man as both the physical and the metaphysical or philosophical center of creation has, of course, increasingly come under attack. And not only with the discovery, lo and behold, that not everything circles around the Earth, that the Earth, in fact, circles around the sun, and that there's a whole solar system, of which Earth is certainly not the physical center. We occupy just one galaxy of many, the Milky Way, and that Earth is in really the far reaches of the Milky Way. And then further scientific discoveries, of course, with the Hubble telescope in the 20th century, that indeed it's quite possible on the basis of that, plus the theory of relativity, that the universe is not stable, that it continues to exist, which we then trace backward also on the basis of fossil evidence and so on and so forth. Carbon dating, etc., that the Earth was created not that recently, and that human beings, of course, later on, are with Darwin, are descended from apes. And these are all developments that really punctured major holes in our perception as to the place of the human being in the universe. It's no wonder that that the church did not exactly receive some of these findings with open arms, which is a really nice way of putting it. We don't have to go through the entire history. We're generally, I think many of us are aware of the general strokes. But certainly you get the idea that over the course of the modern period, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th centuries, there really have been dramatic questions raised about the traditional accounting of the physical place of the man's, of the physical sense of man's place in the universe, as well as our relationship to other created beings. And it's not just that. It's not just the notion of evolution, that we evolved from more primitive forms and hominids and so on and so forth. Lucy, our friend the hominid. But it's more than that. It's really the theory of natural selection that goes along with that, which claims that essentially we evolve in much the same way as the animal kingdom. Survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest is not exactly an ethical theory about humanity. Remember that in some of the sources that we saw, there was a linkage between the centrality of the human being and the ethical standing of the person, of the human being. Remember Mirandola, at long last, however, I feel that I've come to some understanding why man is the most fortunate of living things and consequently deserving of all admiration. Well, if together with Tennyson in his classic poem In Memoriam, published in 1850, we conclude that the human being is red in tooth and claw, so that's a pretty harsh condemnation of the human being on the ethical plane as well. And once we're questioning the standing of human being and our ability to even distinguish ourselves from the animal kingdom with regard to free will and so on and so forth, so many of modern scientific findings about intelligence among mammals, and dolphins and so on, the chimpanzee, raise further questions with regard to the uniqueness of man. And again, even the notion of free will itself has come under heavy fire, in particular in the 20th and now the 21st centuries. Really, the dual revolutions of the movements of the genetic revolution alongside the neuroscientific revolution have raised key questions with regard to our ability to really make independent determinations. Well, if everything is determined genetically and all we have to do is to decode your genome, and really you don't make decisions, essentially all we comprise of, there's no such thing as a soul or notion of consciousness, we are ultimately boil down to a bunch of neurons that fire at will, and you put these different theories together, so there are all these together I think really assail and bring many of the traditional theories under attack from a number of key and far-reaching a discipline that all bring to bear, bring pressure on the traditional against, really evidence against the traditional notion of our place in the universe. And then on the ethical side of things, I think that there have been some developments in the 20th century in particular. The traumatic implications of two world wars, followed by the Cold War, I think has continued to carry with it, in particular in the aftermath of World War II, a real sense of trauma, in which Western civilization has asked itself some very hard questions about who we are, and our values, and our ability to maintain peace, and our ability to create a world in which we have the ethical advancements to properly harness the frightening instruments of war, technological advancements that we have brought to bear, and plus the egalitarian streak of postmodern society, really modern and postmodern society, in which not only is the default assumption that all human beings are equal, which I think is generally a pretty good thing, but then extending that beyond humans to animals, and that flattening that we find, all of these really raise key questions. So to set up our questions, really the issue is, can we maintain, or do we maintain, the traditional Jewish position nowadays? Really, how do we understand our place in the universe? And how does Judaism respond to this onslaught from a whole range of different disciplines in the modern period that raise such fundamental questions about some of the positions that we've seen? And some of the lines that we see here, really, they don't really resonate, do they? The notion that Rav Sadia says that we are unquestionably the intended purpose of creation, it's very hard to imagine a modern writer writing in that kind of way. That we are deserving of all admiration, as Mirandola said, that just as the sun reigns, so a man is a king, as Maharal claims. These are sentences that don't necessarily resonate for us in nearly the same way that perhaps they did at earlier stages in history. So this is really by way of opening up this set of questions, and what we'll have to do over the course of the remaining classes is to explore this question: does Judaism have space for, do some of the earlier traditional accounts allow space for seeing man a little bit differently, and yet at the same time, how do we defend the traditional perspectives on man's place in the universe? And just before concluding, just two real asides that I think are significant enough that they are worth mentioning, but really they are somewhat asides, at least a little bit. The first is, we mentioned the twin revolutions of the genetic and neuroscientific advances of the 20th and now 21st centuries, which I think are really very relevant. I just want to point out that in each case there is a cutting edge area of research that portends the possibility of pushing back. So on the genetic and moving more in the direction of free will and consciousness. So on the genetic side, we now have the notion of epigenetics. And what epigenetics basically teach is that I have the ability myself, and there are actually ramifications for future generations, but even for myself, I have the ability through my behaviors to activate or deactivate certain genes. So my genes exist, and to some extent they operate, but how dominant are they? Through my, not only my environment, but my own decisions through epigenetics, I can actually determine, or my behavior has major ramifications for me, and then also separately for future generations, in terms of how active or dominant my various genes might be. And I think that that's a very relevant and fruitful potentially fruitful avenue, certainly in the medical world, with regard to cancer study and so on, but also philosophically as well. That's one. On the neuroscientific side of things, so the newfound research with regard to the plasticity of the brain and the notion that the brain is not a fully formed or a complete organ, but rather that through, by exercising different parts of my brain, that I can actually reshape my brain in the way that the neurons fire, again, allows for the possibility that I can actually rewire myself. And that, I think, has significant and, again, potentially very fruitful possibilities as well. One last point, just as an aside, we mentioned the Avos Rabbi Nasan, Minayin Sha'adam Shekul Keneged Koma Asabereshes Shneemar Zeh Sefer Toldos Adam. So 2 points in this regard. Number one, is a fantastic midrash that exists in various forms. The most expansive form appears in the Ein Yaakov. I think it's in the introduction to the Ein Yaakov. Both Rav Amital Zecher Tzadik Levracha and Rav Lichtenstein Yibadal Chaim Tovim Aruchim, the Rashi Yeshiva of Yeshivat Har Tzion, were both want to quote different parts of this midrash. And the midrash, in its fullest, its most complete form, asks, or at least its longest form, asks, what is the most important pasuk in the Torah? That's a pretty significant question. One answer, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Okay, that we can understand. Another one, perhaps surprising, Rav Lichtenstein likes to cite this one, Esakeves echad ta'aseh v'boker v'esakeves ashni ta'aseh bin ha'arbayim, the mitzvah of offering sacrifices in the morning and at night, the mitzvah of the korbanos tamid, and this seems to point to the importance of a constancy, consistency, of hard work day in, day out, of grit, we might say, in our avodas Hashem. The third pasuk, quoted in at least one extant version of the midrash, is that in fact it's this pasuk of Zeh Sefer Toldos Adam, perhaps, which can be rendered or understood in different ways, but perhaps the notion of appreciating our significance in creation, that really is a centerpiece or a foundational text in all of Jewish thought, which rivals a pasuk like V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, or this notion of the Karbanos Tamid, I think is truly remarkable. And the final point I wanted to mention is I can't mention this midrash and this pasuk without mentioning an interpretation, a very moving interpretation I heard from Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblatt of the Riverdale Jewish Center. And Rabbi Rosenblatt understood as follows, Zeh Sefer Toldos Adam, that our job, our responsibility, is to study a human being in much the same way that we study a text, a sefer. Zeh Sefer Toldos Adam. What does that mean? Suggested Rabbi Rosenblatt that it's fascinating that when we open a book, we are trained, as Jews in particular, to be extremely analytic. We open up the book, we look at the text, we open up, right, we see the block Gemara, and we analyze what is the Mishnah saying, what is the Gemara saying, and how do the two interrelate, and we make every single deal possible. We read it very carefully, very closely, and try to tease out the exact meaning of the passage, and then Rashi and Tosos and so on and so forth. A text we read extremely carefully and analyze with a very close eye. However, when it comes to people, very often we don't necessarily think of a person as an object of study, not in a detached kind of way, but I mean in a very helpful and rich kind of way. In other words, we don't necessarily think of the person standing next to us as someone who possesses all the depth of a sefer and then some. Very often when we interact with people, we don't do so, we neglect to do so, by first seeking to the best of our ability to really understand who they are, what makes them tick, what makes them really who they are, how are they likely to respond to what it is that I'm going to say, and how can I moderate and formulate my language and even my body motions in a way that they're most likely to be receptive to what it is that I have to say. Well, every person is different in that regard. And every person is a sefer. Says the Torah, and perhaps the most fundamental principle of the Torah, is V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha. Okay, that's very nice. That's one level. One should love another person like myself. But then we're using myself as the blueprint for how I interact with others. Says the Midrash, no, there's another explanation, equally but opposite. in its significance, in its direction. Don't just say V'avta l'recha kamocha, use myself as the basis for how I interact with others, but rather start the other way around. The Sefer told us, Adam, that if I understand the other person like a Sefer, that if I really think about the other individual and who they are and what makes them a unique person, that will allow me to interact with them and to be respectful to them, to show them the kavod that is embedded in the charge of the Ahavta, or the love that is embedded in the charge of the Ahavta L'Re'acha Kamocha, and to really interact with them in a way that is truly respectful and can be so transformative that ultimately this way of interacting with my fellow person like a Sefer, not to be dissected in an overly analytical sense, but to be esteemed and respected as an independent, individual, unique, dignified human being, and that has dramatic implications for how I'm meant to interact with him or her, that principle of ben adam l'chaveru, that way of interacting with my friends, is so foundational that perhaps that is ultimately the most important pasuk in the entirety of the Torah. Okay, we will stop here. God willing, as we proceed in this mini-series, we will explore alternative conceptions, alternative resolutions to the problems that we have outlined. And we'll see a number of fantastic sources, in particular examining the thought of Rav Soloveitchik as he sought to address these questions as we go along. Have a wonderful day.